Hi, you've tuned in to Boho Bisbee. This is Patricia, and I'm sitting with the illustrious Michael Gregory. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we're here to talk again, which is always a pleasure. We're going to talk about your time as the chair with Sierra Club and the Poetry Festival, and we're even going to hear some poetry from Michael Gregory, which is going to be such a gift. I know we've talked about the Central School and the history of your residence here, southeast part of Arizona. How did you become chair?
Well, first to clarify, I was never chair in that sense. I was the conservation chair, which is, you know, one of the possible positions to have as a volunteer in the Sierra Club local chapter, or in this case, the state chapter. It came about because I was working for the Forest Service. I had a lookout tower up in the Apache Sitgraves Forests in northeast Arizona. And it was during a time when the Forest Service was going through what they called the Rare 2 inventory, the roadless area review and evaluation of lands that were suitable for inclusion in the National Wilderness Act. And we had some lands up there that were good candidates. And some of us who worked for the Forest Service decided to get together and see if we could help those lands become part of the wilderness system. So while we were doing that, we put out a little pamphlet and so forth and so on. Not an official Forest Service publication at all, but just some volunteers working for what we thought were beautiful land. And I was visited then by a couple of people who were also working on getting those same lands put into the system. Turns out they were representatives in the area of the Wilderness Society and the Sierra Club. And the Wilderness Society representative was David Foreman, who later became very well known as the head of Earth First. The other one was Linda Lewis, who was the chair, the executive chair, for the Grand Canyon chapter of the Sierra Club. And they said, look, we're working on the same stuff. Do you want to work together? And I said, absolutely. It sounds good to me. But I'm also working on the issue of herbicides in the Forest Service, and I would like to make a deal with you. We work together on wilderness. We work together on that. And they said, absolutely, that we want to. So I got involved with the Sierra Club that way. We started swapping information and so forth. I started writing articles for the state newsletter. And then after doing that for a while, I got really involved in the club. And after I stopped working full-time for the Sierra Club, or part of the year for the Sierra Club during fire season, I decided I would get more involved with the club's internal structure, at which point I became the conservation chairman for the club.
And you were with them for how long?
Oh, 5-6 years. Or the club? I was with the club 10-15 years. I was the conservation chair for, I don't know, maybe 10 of those from the late 70s into the mid-80s. In 1990, I had a number of titles with the Sierra Club, both in the state and internationally and nationally. And in 1990, I gave all of those up because I formed a nonprofit organization, Arizona Toxics Information, to work specifically on toxics issues.
Like, and that's still presently going?
No, I retired basically from everything back in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And I just let all of that go and decided I wanted to spend more time at home. Maybe figuring out, more about my personal life and how to deal with, the last years of that, which were coming on all too fast.
What claims to fame through your personal group did you achieve?
Well, I think I'm pretty clear about that in my own head, actually. First of all, in that kind of work, you don't achieve anything by yourself. The environmental movement is a movement. It is not individuals.
And a one-person act.
It's not a one-person act. Nothing that I achieved was done by me alone. It was always us. It was always a group. Many, many people, in some cases, people I'd never met, who were like-minded on a particular issue and so forth. That having been said, all of the things I did, or most of the things I did, let's put it that way, and that there is a written paper trail for, are in fact included on my website as written documents. And so if people want to look at michaelgregoryaz.net, they will find a section there called Environment, and in that are many, many of my papers and comments to the government and talks, etc., all documented there under the section called Looking at the Planet, which was a collection of my papers that I put together back in the early 2000s. Then again, going back to what those things were. By then, I was living in Southeast Arizona. I was living in McNeil, where I still live. One of the first issues that came to my attention was the Douglas smelter. And I decided I had to look into that because, I came home one day from the Forest Service and I couldn't see across the valley. Thought it was smoke from forest fire, but it turned out to be the Douglas smelter. And I could not live with that. So I got involved in that in 1975. And over the years, met many other people who were involved with that through various organizations and actions, etc., including a group in Bisbee that was called GASP, Groups Against Smelter Pollution, groups out in the valley. We got national groups, including the Sierra Club, involved in that issue. And it was connected with various things were going on at the time, including renewal of the Clean Air Act and other stuff. And so that action took a number of years, but in 1986, the Douglas smelter was shut down. Almost at the same time, I got very much involved. Again, these are like issues in my backyard that I got involved with. And I guess part of that is like something I've always said to people. I never got involved in environmental issues for altruistic reasons. It wasn't because I thought Mother Earth needed to be saved or anything like that. It was really self-defense. I always felt my involvement in environment was self-defense. I could not live with the Douglas smelter in my lungs, so I had to work on that. Similarly, I got involved, as I say, about the same time with the San Pedro River. The San Pedro was obviously a spot that was very important environmentally, high diversity of animals, especially birds, and so forth, and running water in the southwest, which, is very unusual. And it turns out that at that time, the San Pedro was particularly imperiled because all of the land, the major part of the land around the river, the lower part of the river in the state, had just been bought up by Tenneco Corporation for subdivision. And subdividing that area, I thought, would be a travesty. And so I started looking into that issue, found some other like-minded people, Natalie Danforth, who lives in Bisbee, who at that time was the conservation chairman, I believe, for the Audubon Society in Cochise County, and some other people, and we all agreed that we had to do something to save the river. So I was a printer at that time. I had access to printing equipment. We put out a little pamphlet called Save the San Pedro, which was, I think, the first thing ever put out about that issue. That, again, took many years to fulfill, but it included the Sierra Club. It included Defenders of Wildlife. It included Audubon Society. Many other organizations got involved because of what we started there. And, of course, eventually the land got declared federal property under President Reagan, actually signed that bill, and is still, of course, managed by the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, under the Department of Interior because of the legislation that we wrote at that time. I've gotten involved in other issues in the area. One of the first issues I got involved with when I was in the Sierra Club was the development of the first Arizona Wilderness Bill. And many of us, again, got together with the Wilderness Society and other organizations and figured out that there were a number of areas in the state which really needed to be saved as wilderness. Again, some of those were in my backyard. Miller Peak was one of them. An expansion of the Chiricahua Monument was another one. And so for a couple of years, we got involved, that the group of us were involved in writing a bill, mapping out those areas that we felt should be part of the bill, which included hiking out a lot of those areas, which was fun. I enjoyed doing that. We got up into the high Chiricahua area, the really tall, high peaks, Chiricahua Peak, and the others over there into the subalpine forest, very unusual in the Southwest, which part of what we decided needed to be saved. So I was involved in doing that kind of work with the club. From the local group, got involved on toxics issues nationwide with the club, got involved in cross-border issues, did a lot of work on the maquiladoras, hooked up with other groups in the area, especially with the help of Dick Camp. Dick and I formed an organization called the Border Ecology Project, which when I developed Arizona toxics information in 1990 and dropped out of the Sierra Club, I also dropped out of that, but Dick kept that going for many, many years. Still has it going, I believe under different names now. But we got involved with groups in Mexico to fight not only the Douglas smelter problem, but many other toxics issues in Mexico. Got involved with the right to know kinds of issues, which became the primary thing that I was involved with in Arizona toxics information. People's right to know about what they're being poisoned with. And so we dealt with that both in Mexico and the United States. Got involved when NAFTA came in with the tri-national efforts to monitor and control toxics in Canada, Mexico, and the United States. That kicked me off into international work on toxics. We did some work on developing those kinds of right-to-know issues and programs and projects that nations could do worldwide to deal with toxics problems. And I got involved particularly with groups that were working to develop an international treaty on some of the worst toxics, things like dioxins and PCBs that were in the environment that we needed to stop putting into the environment and clean up what was already there. So I got involved for several years on helping write the Stockholm Convention on persistent organic pollutants, or POPs. And that was actually signed as an international UN action in the year 2000.
Wonderful.
So that was about the time, having done that, having started with dioxin and Agent Orange in the national forests, I felt like I had pretty much done that job and I could retire from that work. So shortly after that Stockholm Convention was signed, I dropped out, let Arizona Toxics die, and continued my environmental work as an individual, people asking me, you know, for information and advice. I became an advisor, and only an advisor. Went on the line, online with my website, and started doing what I'm basically doing now, which is gathering environmental news, progressive politics news in a lot of ways, gathering that into little packets of information that I forward out to people on a mailing list.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's been wonderful that you've carried on, that you've continued to network with people, that there's a strong sense of need now, presently, for not just Environmental Watch, but to be talking with our legislature. Do you think that that the momentum is carrying forward what you created?
Well, again, we created.
Right.
The 70s was the first Earth Day. That's a worldwide movement. And yes, what we were doing back in those days has carried forward, and probably we're in more need of it now than we were then, although that's a hard call to make. We had some very serious problems in those days of air pollution and water pollution. A lot of those got much better because of what we were doing back then. Some of them haven't. And climate change, you know, has come to the fore since then. Even though people were talking about it almost 50 years ago, nobody was paying attention. Just like Rachel Carson started talking about pollution back in the early days, the 50s, nobody paid attention. It took 20 years for those to become international issues. Climate change, the same thing. It took 25, 30 years for people to really start paying attention. And now, of course, we're in the midst of it. So it's,
We are experiencing it.
Climate change is real. The change in climate is just obvious to anybody paying attention. And although those who want to protect the industries and the way of life, the capitalist system that allowed this to happen, and the socialist system, I mean, socialism is just as bad with industrialism as capitalism, those worldwide economic methods of doing business that caused the problem are still there. And those people who want to defend that have fought our understanding of climate change. Even if they say that's not what caused it, they cannot deny that it's real and that something's got to be done.
Instead of being in the problem, they really need to become the answer.
It may
they need
be,
to be
the
involved.
Own, the, it may be the biggest issue out there. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of issues. We've got pandemics. We've got corrupt politics. We've got worldwide authoritarian movements, you know, like the Trump cult is into. We have, you know, a multitude of major issues all hitting at once.
How does one become focused and not overwhelmed by everything that's going down?
Well, not being overwhelmed is a real issue, especially for people who have tended not to be involved until now. All of a sudden, this is overwhelming because they never dealt with anything before in their lives in terms of politics. Politics has, you know, been taught to people as something not to get involved with. Ever since, especially Reagan's era, we've been told politics is dirty, don't get involved. Which means, of course, the people who are involved are the dirty people. You know, they're the ones who are going to control stuff, mm-hmm. which basically means big money. Since Reagan era, again, big money has controlled both parties. Before that, there really was a working class people's movement that the Democrats respected and responded to. They still do much more than the Republicans, but big money runs everything in both parties.
It does.
I don't think a third party is the way out of that, but reform certainly has got to be part of that.
Mm-hmm. I agree. We could talk about this all day. Let's talk about the Poetry Festival and how the New Moon Poetry Group was created.
Back in the 70s, there were a small group of us who got together, I think every month, in what we called the New Moon Poetry Society. And where we got together was the Carmen and Peter's living room in the Philadelphia Hotel. And it was Carmen and Peter, that was Carmen McGath and Peter Young, Betsy Easterday, Betsy Thornton, Bob Feldman, John Friedman, less but often, and a few other people. I'm sure I'm leaving people out, but I'm sorry, I don't remember everybody at the moment. But it was the same people who had been, for the most part, were involved with Cochise Fine Arts, which was a group that had taken over a space down on Subway Street and put in what they called an alternative art gallery. It was involved several people from New York City, myself, who was a fairly recent transplant from California, and others of us who came from various places. But like I say, we would get together and read each other's work and critique each other's mm-hmm. work. Somewhere along in the late 70s, we started talking about doing some kind of an event that would bring known poets to Bisbee. That evolved into what became the Bisbee Poetry Festival. We got seriously talking about that in 77 and 78. John Friedman, who I believe at that time was the director of Cochise Cochise Fine Arts, a New Yorker, Bob Feldman, Peter Young, all of whom had contacts in New York, said they felt that through their contacts they could get some really big names to come to a festival kind of event. And those names included people like Ginsberg and some of the other beat poets. They were very hot on the beat movement. All of us knew the beat movement, of course, in those days. And so that's what happened. The original festival began with an emphasis on beat poets, and that took off in 79. Lawrence Ferlinghetti was part of that. Lawrence gave us a poem of his that he wrote while he was here in Bisbee called Mule Mountain Dreams. That can still be bought at various, at the bookstores around Bisbee. We printed that, that is the Bisbee Press Collective, printed that on my presses, and it is still available to people. We did a lot of that kind of work, a collective work between the Press Collective, the Poetry Festival, and Cochise Fine Arts. And that went on. I was involved with that for 4 or 5 years. Most of the people who started it were involved for 4 or 5 years. Well, August Schaefer was another one of those original people. And toward the end of those 4 or 5 years, other people had gotten involved. And some of us who wanted out, we said, how can we keep it going? August agreed to become the director. Up until then, we had always had co-directors. All of those who were involved were co-directors, but one person would take the lead among the directors. And that, at the beginning, was John Friedman. It became others of us later on. Then after we had the changing of hands, as it were, August agreed to be the director. And she got other people involved, and they continued it for several years after I was no longer really involved.
I think that you brought some poetry with you.
I did.
Would you share some?
I would be glad to read a piece that is really a current, pretty current piece.
Lovely.
And I'm
and
hoping...
when was this written? And give us a little bit of a background to its...
I think it'll explain itself in a lot of ways. But the immediate background is that it is part of what I hope will be my next book.
And you've published... poetry and other books?
I've only published poetry. My prose work, as I said, is on my website, and especially in the environment section, where I have collected my papers and talks and so forth. There's also a poetry section on the website. I've never tried to publish a book of prose. I came to Bisbee, came to this area. I've never lived in Bisbee, but I came to this area, as I've always said, to raise my own food and to write poetry. So this piece, as I said, is in a work in progress, which I hope will be done progressing very soon and, in fact, become a publication. If somebody out there wants to grab this and publish it, I want to talk to you. The book itself is called Times Two. This piece is called We Were the Love Generation. And it begins with an epigraph from John Lennon. All you need is love. We were the love generation in that century of war and atrocities. Our lives spent chasing our tails from bedroom trade deals to board game currencies to cultural and intellectual capital. Antique mating rituals in modern undress. Driven out of the cities, sometimes of our minds with luck, afraid they too had been made, had, by the killing machine, not knowing if we had gone mad or were the few still sane in an insane, bankrupt, and out-of-date quasi-civilization, unsure where or how or if to draw lines between fascination, imagination, and hallucination, or how to conceive a reality unadulterated by such stuff as the reason and belief we were born into, accessories to the crimes that sickened us ab ovo, all too human refills for entry-level positions, impelled by sex-crazed genes to perpetuate our kind, while trying to find a way out from in under, to get behind the sense of loss at the outset, the skipped first beat, the zero constitutive of the sequence, but still empty. The heart's desire to overcome the difficulty blind monads have communicating. The slim chance of recognizing who or what, besides reproductions of our own alienation, cunning configurations of illusory objects and subjects we seem to keep bumping into on our shortcuts toward death. But knowing, despite ourselves, feeling in our guts and marrow, the urgent need for wisdoms to counter prejudice, hate, injustice, greed, with countervailing values, beauty, grace, compassion, love, having nothing to do with competition, ownership, or power games, but rather the need to feel free from the cash nexus, the fossil fuel death wish investiture, the racketeering of hot and cold war, embezzling our life savings so we spend our expectancies in the poorhouse of workaday meaninglessness. Yet unable, even with the best intentions, to bring together enchantment by the new with peace of mind in the commonplace, or find the grail of pluralism without the rot of individual egos on the one hand, utter schizophrenia on the other. Dog eat dog, business class anarchy, ladders of knives in the backs of our kin, legs spread, face to the wall, up against the simple fact that difference gains identity and catalytic potential only when embedded in cultural ferment. That diversity is not a good in itself, but only in communitas. That ideas are a dime a dozen, only actions count. That we seem to be not only intransitive verbs looking for nouns in a primal soup of prepositions and interjections, but cognitive fields made up of memory, will, fear, and imagination, driven by desire to be continued. That our essential obligation is not to ourselves or the community, order, truth, or power, but to this relationship we've let go to hell. The soil smothered under sheets of concrete and macadam, the waters poisoned and dried to salt-encrusted clay, the air choked with broken promises, the family ties and animal spirits broken, this mortal world, this home we share with each other.
It's powerful, thank you. Our time is up, and it's been a delight, and I have no doubt we'll meet again for another interview. There's just too much to talk about, to cover. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Patricia.